Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us today for our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond are Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and a little later in the program, former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many roles is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mackenzie and Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Great to be back, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our cyber coverage and our weekly cyber report. Fincon Thierry Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our coverage of air and missile defense. Michael, Congress is back next week. Republicans are in a purging mood. Liz Cheney ought to lose her number three spot, which means that all top three leaders of the House will all be members who voted against certifying Joe Biden as president of the United States and have endorsed the notion bought in to the notion of Donald Trump's lie that the 2020 election was somehow stolen. Meanwhile, GOP members in Washington are furiously opposing Biden's COVID and infrastructure measures while back home touting the benefits that both of these packages are giving their members. So it's always good to see that disingenuousness is alive and well in American politics now as Americans like cicadas start to emerge from the darkness that has been COVID. I have this sense of Washingtonians sort of suckling on tree sap for the last year as they prepare to reemerge and clog the roads. Michael, talk to us a little bit about the turmoil the Republican House leadership is in, and what are the implications for national security, if any?
Sure. There are implications for national security. So first, Liz Cheney survived an attempt to unseat her in leadership about a month or two ago, but time flies. And, now it looks like she will not have support to stay, and she is actually not even trying. She's not out there making phone calls and moving votes in order to stay. And I think, the frustration really is not necessarily with Liz Cheney's, core beliefs, but the fact that she's not trying to duck the questions when asked by reporters, and not even that, but also, actively tweeting, where it's causing discord in Republican ranks and also among Republican donor base, where people are threatening not to give as long as she's still in the leadership. So if this is going to happen in the Republican leadership, it's better it happens now. I mean, we're only in May, so we're not even 5 months into the new Congress. They can rip this Band-Aid off now and people forget about it come election time a year and a half from now. And it's interesting, too, that, Liz Cheney is a member of the Armed Services Committee. We really haven't had people from the Armed Services Committee in leadership. And she'll be replaced by, looks like, Elise Stefanik, who is on the Armed Services Committee and was a subcommittee chair when the Republicans were in charge and now is a ranking member. So when Stefanik does get into leadership, which is expected to happen on Wednesday, that will result in lots of musical chairs on the ranking memberships on the Armed Services Committee. Jim Banks will likely get a chance to get off of personnel and onto possibly the subcommittee that Elise Stefanik is the ranking member on cyber. And then that could pave the way now for Mike Gallagher possibly to become a ranking member on a committee, which would be personnel. And, there'll be big changes actually a year and a half from now because Vicky Hartzler is looking probably to run for the Senate. So that would open up her ranking membership on tackier land. Mike Turner's looking at a Senate race, or if not, possibly the chairmanship or ranking membership of the Intelligence Committee. So his ranking membership will open up. That coupled with, who knows if Stephanie Murphy runs for the Senate, if Matt Gaetz is still in Congress. So big changes coming on armed services. And I should mention Kristi Houlihan also looking at a Senate run. And almost half the Democrats on defense appropriations are no longer going to be on that committee next year because they've either announced their retirement or announcing a run for the Senate as well. So big changes coming in the near term and within the next year and a half on defense on those committees.
Mackenzie, what's your sense on all of this? Because I mean, the party is really buying in at a very senior leadership level to very sort of fundamentally dangerous, right? I mean, there was nothing untoward nor unseemly in the election, and the senior leadership voted against the constitutional procedure to install a legitimately elected president of the United States. And as long as leader, right? I mean, Liz Cheney, more members should be standing up and saying, hey, wait a minute, there's something wrong here, as opposed to sort of going along with that. Talk to us a little bit about that, but more broadly, what some of these changes will mean for national security in a more meaningful manner, given, you know, it is a fait accompli at this point.
It's a worrisome trend, but family feuds are ugly. This has been a problem, but I mean, let's go back to like the rise of the Tea Party. I mean, there's always, it seems like the right is always at war with itself. So to be totally fair, the subject is different and of great seriousness, but what's happening is not, although this is pretty remarkable what's happening in leadership. Still, the party is united, however, around one thing, and that is that China's a big, scary threat and we got to do more about it. So, you know, perhaps and to slow the rate, you know, the potential of $6 trillion or something in new spending. So I would say there's unity around two big ideas, those two, to not spend as much money as President Biden has proposed, and that much more needs to be done by Washington, by Congress in particular, but also the White House and federal agencies unified to combat China. So I think in the end, you know, that's once this is over, you know, this what's happening in leadership, I think, you know, they'll continue to focus on those two issues.
I do think it's interesting that Mitch McConnell's position with Joe Biden is pretty much identical to his position with Barack Obama, right? I have to stop him at all costs. That's my 100% goal, is to stop everything. So Dr. No or Senator No, what is it, graveyard? He was proud that he was the graveyard of legislation once upon a time. Michael, talk to us a little bit about the update on the budget request. Where are we? And on infrastructure as well, because I think it's very, very interesting. Again, as I noted in the introduction, some of these measures, both on COVID as well as on infrastructure, are proving remarkably popular, including in very cast iron Republican parts of the country, whether it was Lake Charles, where a Republican mayor wants a bridge in his town that folks haven't been able to replace for decades. And the brilliance of the legislation the administration put together is there are a lot of sweeteners in a lot of places that have been looking, whether it's for road money or bridge money or other investment monies across the board.
Well, look, let me start with the budget real quick, because we'll talk about things that are not happening before we talk about things that are happening. So the budget continues to be delayed. The latest information on the Hill is that they expect the budget sometime between May 24th and 26th. Although there are rumors now that I believe probably will be prove out to be true, that the budget may not arrive now until early June. So that means that the House Armed Services Committee, for example, who is scheduled to mark up their bill on June 30th, will now no longer be able to do so. Because Adam Smith was hoping to get his bill off the floor before the August recess. Senate has already capitulated, so they're going to mark up right now. Their plan is to mark up July 21st with floor action in September. I expect the House Armed Services Committee to follow a similar schedule. And however, the appropriators are marching to a completely different drum. I mean, Rosa DeLauro, the new chair of the House Appropriations Committee, has said that she plans to mark up all her bills in June and have floor action in July, which would mean a defense appropriations bill would have floor action in July before the August recess. I hope she can stick to that schedule. You know, as far as infrastructure goes, I mean, look, right now, we're pretty much nowhere on infrastructure. I mean, Biden's already talking about his second infrastructure package before the first one has even been passed. I think they're going to go through this charade of bipartisan discussion until the Democrats figure out what it is they can jam in through reconciliation. But I mean, your point is valid. There are things that are popular in here when it gets to infrastructure, right? You know, bridges, roads, tunnels. But that's part of the rub here, is the definition of what is infrastructure. I mean, the Republicans want a bill that does focus on those traditional definitions of infrastructure, which would be a smaller price tag around $600 to $800 billion, where Democrats are looking at something as high as possibly $2.5 trillion for the first package and another $1.5 trillion or more in the second package. And then I think the whole thing—
We should point out though, right? I mean, these are over a decade. So these aren't sort of one-year bills, and it would not be a one-year authorization nor a one-year appropriation for what it's worth.
Yes, that is true. But I think where things are breaking down and will continue to break down too is not only on the definition of infrastructure, but also on how do you pay for it, right? So I think there are plenty of Democrats that do not want to vote for tax increases, whether they're considered for the wealthy or for corporations or people are capital gains because they've got an election in a year and a half, and we're going to be facing redistricting. A lot of people are going to be facing new districts, and an off-year election when the Democrats have the White House, they need to worry about losing seats because that is the historic pattern. So I think that that's going to be problematic. And to get back to your earlier point on what is infrastructure, I mean, you did mention before money for shipbuilding, shipyards, and now there's talk about space being part of infrastructure and money for our for that. So how does that get defined? I think that the more complicated they make it, the harder it's going to be to pass. Or can they break it up into, instead of two bills, into several smaller bills? That remains to be seen. But right now, it's not on the calendar for May, which they were hoping that it would be. I mean, they're going to be in for 2 weeks until they break again for another recess for Memorial Day. And the things on the calendar are not related to this. The closest thing that has a relation to national security is they're hoping to possibly do the supplemental package on security following the January 6th insurrection. So not only security funding for the Capitol, but the possibility of creating a commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection, if they could come to terms on what the commission's jurisdiction really will be, because that's still the rub right now.
I'm going to go to Mackenzie in a second, but where do we stand on the infrastructure measure, right? I mean, it has a very, very bipartisan core from shipbuilding states that includes the likes of Tim Kaine, but also Roger Wicker, right? I mean, almost every delegation that includes shipyards thinks that this is a good idea. And there are a lot of strategists who say it is a good idea, right? I mean, we had Todd Harrison last week, I think, talking about why space should be considered as critical infrastructure. I'm one of the people who believes that, once upon a time, it was all about canals and toll roads. And we, started putting, technology changes. So we put railroads and eventually we put airports and eventually, broadband is part of that as well. Where do you think the shipyard measure stands? I mean, is there enough traction for that? Do you think more broadly to push that rock up the hill, especially in a bipartisan manner?
Yes, I think if there is a bipartisan compromise on infrastructure, that would stand a pretty good chance of getting in. But I think we're still miles away from figuring out how they're going to define infrastructure, what it's going to be, and if we're really going to have a bipartisan compromise. I would love to see that. I hope we'll see that. I am not convinced we're going to see that. I think in the end, that the Democrats are going to have to jam something through through reconciliation and figure out what it is their people are willing to accept. And
what Joe Manchin is willing to accept.
Well, I think that's true, but I think that they've got to worry about other senators too. Joe Manchin is getting a lot of attention now, and rightfully so, but there are a lot of Democrats that are in some tough re-elects. Like if I'm Senator Hassan from New Hampshire and I'm worried about Governor Sununu running against me for Senate, I'm not so sure I want to vote to increase taxes. Right. And I think also the two Arizona senators, Mark Kelly and Kristen Sinema, are wild cards on that. And the House is not a slam dunk. I mean, once all the special elections are filled, Pelosi can only afford to lose 4 votes. And if you're a Democrat who beat a Republican in 2018 and survived 2020, and now have new lines drawn in 22, I don't know if you want to vote for higher taxes. I mean, when you're explaining, you're losing, even though a lot of your constituents may not be affected by those taxes, it's still going to be problematic. And I think the Democrats have a lot of explaining to do on the relief packages they've already passed. I mean, look, we saw the employment numbers today. They were not good. And unemployment is now up to 6.1%. And a lot of that is because people are being paid to stay home to work. There are a lot of small businesses throughout the country, especially here in D.C., restaurants who cannot get help because people are being paid to stay home to work. So I think there's a lot of buyer's remorse. I've talked to a lot of Democrats about this on the Hill, and they all acknowledge that this is a problem and there's nothing they can do about it until it runs out at the end of September. And the question will be, will these businesses and will these restaurants be open in October for these people to come back to work?
Mackenzie, let me get your sense on where we are in the budget request, infrastructure, and all of that, as Michael and I ran on a little bit longer with our discussion on that, even though it was very value add for our audience. Go ahead.
There is broad support on the, shipyard infrastructure, sort of maintenance funding, which is great, honestly. But like, it's a little ironic because I remember when in the last administration talking about infrastructure, there was a push that really we need to focus on virtual infrastructure too, the internet and satellite connectivity for the military primarily, but really stuff that the American economy relies on pretty heavily, right? So like GPS, right? Obviously we use it to enable our smart weapons, but at the same time, kids play Pokemon Go, with that same sort of technology. And all of our systems are vulnerable. All of those need updates. China and Russia have already shown that they can, take these out in a conflict, and it's time to update virtual infrastructure too. So I understand the war doesn't mean anything anymore in Washington, but there are legitimate uses of this money. And shipyards are important, but the software and the technology and the enabling tools like undersea cables and satellites and all of that are also part of the infrastructure that needs to be considered. You know, I think it was interesting this week, the unity on the House Armed Services Committee in their views and estimates letter to the House Budget Committee chairman, where they basically said, you know, President Biden's defense top line is significantly below what's required to do all of the things that the department itself says is needed. And every single Republican signed it, and they're calling for a 3-5% growth. The focus of course, is on China in the letter, but also, you know, the nuclear deterrent and other priorities like readiness and rebuilding it after the Budget Control Act era. So, you know, Republicans aren't going to let up on this, no matter what the Deputy Secretary of Defense says, that she's fascinated that people are focused on the top line without knowing what's in it. Well, that's actually, I take issue with that comment, because we know enough about the defense budget that so much of it is fixed. It doesn't, you know, they can tweak, but they didn't make anything but decisions that are going to make politicians mad in it. So I think it's fair that members don't need much more information than that to know that they are not, they're adding mission and they're not taking away, and they're, while they're, you know, slightly reducing dollars, and it's going to continue to be something that, again, unifies the Republican Party going forward.
Well, I mean, right, the drive to ever just spend more money is just an effort not to prioritize, and you don't have to make any hard decisions, right? I mean, you just keep buying the buggy whips while buying the Teslas, and at the end of the day, everybody remains happy. It's when you want to stop buying the buggy whip, or rather when you need to stop buying the buggy whip, right? I mean, there's going to be overlap between the two of them anyway. I think you sense my analogy. Yes. On F-35, Mackenzie, I know Michael is constrained on this in part because of he does represent somebody on the F-35 program. Let me ask you about that letter of support. There are a lot of members who both publicly and privately have expressed reservation about the program. They recognize it's important, as I think Chairman Smith does. The question is whether it does have some significant challenges. I mean, the big trouble is it's sort of the only game in town right now and a little bit too big to fail ultimately. But increasingly, you talk to folks who say, you know, the Air Force should not buy 1,700 of these jets. Maybe the Air Force should be considered, or 1,263, excuse me, maybe should buy 800 and buy more bombers, for example. And then we have this letter, 132 members or so saying, hey, we back F-35, we back more money for F-35. And so on the business podcast, Richard Abulafia of the Thiel Group had mentioned, hey, the only question is how much more money the program gets, right? I mean, so that the program is pretty safe. Where do you think the F-35 program is? And what sort of warning shot is this from the group that supports the program to basically tell everybody back off and don't think about cutting our program?
So the program is in hot water. There's never been this much scrutiny on it, and there was never a safe space for people to criticize it so openly and so many people. So while I do agree ultimately it's going to be fine, particularly in the near term, I don't see any major changes to the program ahead in the near term. But as we've talked about, I want to say a month ago on the report, Bago, you can totally restructure the buy and accelerate near-term purchases, but reduce the total buy for the Air Force. I see that as actually a very likely outcome. And I could see it happening in this administration, potentially in their 2023 request. And so what really happened, though, it is when the chiefs woke up to the sustainment cost of the program. It's not just the engine troubles or the fact that, you know, a dozen jets were down in the Middle East last month, though we also talked about that. There are challenges, you know, across the board, but that's with every program. Look at the Ford class carrier. You've got challenges everywhere. But in particular, it's what the chiefs saw the math. They see the O&M costs, operations and maintenance of this, eating the lunch of everything else. And they all got concerned, not just the Air Force. And that's really, that was the defining moment, I think. And it happened in the last 12 months. And that's where this is sort of coming from. So you either fix that or the program's getting restructured. It's to me, I don't see any other alternative unless those costs come down.
The and just should point out, not to carry water for the program, right? But I think that people have a tendency of forgetting the F-35's cost per flying hour is budgeted fundamentally differently than for any other platform that we have. Generally, combat aircraft are for immediate consumables and fuel, oil, and that kind of stuff. whereas the F-35 is a fully burdened amortized cost for the life of the program. So the cost per flying hour includes depot and a whole bunch of other maintenance. And, you know, I mean, it is a stealthy aircraft, so its maintenance load is a different maintenance load than you would have on a conventional F-16, F-18 type aircraft. Let me shift to Chairman Milley, who, you know, all eyes were on sort of the chemistry between the chairman and the president of the State of the Union. We talked a little bit about it on the after talk of the program last week, which we didn't air as we were breaking up a little bit. Obviously, Chairman Milley was very passionate about staying in Afghanistan. The decision was made to withdraw last Friday. The chairman did make some comments that made did not go well with the White House. And this week, the chairman reversed himself on the issue of whether or not commanders should be taken out of the chain of command when it comes to punishment, the Uniform Code of Military Justice process that falls primarily to commanders with oversight from higher command. Mackenzie, sort of give us your sense on what this change means. For some, it's very welcome to pull commanders who have often or sometimes decide not to punish people who may be guilty because they're otherwise good troops. And especially in sexual assault and sexual harassment, that's become an issue where folks have sort of overlooked and nobody gets punished is the concern by those who feel there hasn't been sufficient accountability. I believe there hasn't been sufficient accountability because if you had more accountability, you'd probably stop this kind of be unacceptable behavior. On the other hand, there are those who say, look, this fundamentally derails how the military works and commander's responsibility and actually is going to open up a whole series of other problems. Sort of broadly, what do you think this change means? And what does this mean for Milley, both inside the Pentagon, but also potentially his fate more broadly with the administration?
Firstly, this highlights what savvy politicians the chiefs are. They love to consider themselves apolitical, but all the generals, all the four stars are essentially politicians to some extent as well. He's seeing the writing on the wall. The confirmation hearings for the now secretary and the deputy secretary of defense, I watched every minute of every word spoken by everyone in those hearings. And the number one takeaway I had from both hearings was that Congress is doing it this year, regardless of what the department wants. And, you know, the department is always a lagging indicator on some big, or not always, can be, you know, has to be forced their hand on some issues, Goldwater, Nichols. We can come up with many Space Force, right? We can come up with lots of different examples. So where this is on the UCMJ is where the Space Force and the Air Force were 5 years ago. I told Air Force leaders, I said, this is coming. It's not whether, it's when. And it came as faster than I even had thought. Same thing with changes to the UCMJ. We can debate the merits of it, but Congress is going to do it for sure. And they are going to do it this year. They're going to start it this year. So the chairman just got on board to a train that had left the station, which, you know, you could say that was smart or that was, kowtowing. Either way, I don't know his personal views on it. And then outside generals, you know, retired influencers were also weighing in as well. Part of this is the last time the Pentagon said, trust us, you know, they've had now a half a decade plus and the numbers have gotten worse. And then there have been these really high profile, awful, terrible murders. It's not just Vanessa Guillen. There are others as well. And it's just a huge problem and it's happening. So what does it say about the chairman? It says he's attuned to the debates in Washington. And, you know, I would say, you know, about his stature or, you know, safety in the position, Congress is going to go, if he were gone tomorrow, Congress would be supportive. If he stays, Congress is going to be supportive. So they're going to defer to the secretary and the president on whether or not he keeps his job, you know, for the full term or not.
And I should point out, we're talking about Afghanistan. I've got to give a shout out to the latest responsible statecraft piece by Dr. Gordon Adams, one of our regulars of the Quincy Institute and a former professor emeritus at American University, also with the Stimson Center. Past was prologue, but Afghanistan shows we never learned the lessons. So I commend everybody to check that out. Michael, very briefly before we end it for a week, I mean, is this at all a topic of conversation that you've had with members, Mark Milley's fate or not?
Surprisingly, no. I mean, this is, I mean, I'm talking to members and staff pretty regularly, and this is something that really never comes up in conversation.
Right. For the last 20 years, the chairman and service chiefs had a disproportionately big role in being able to go directly to the White House and the relationship they had. Whereas that appear, is that what has fundamentally changed in this administration? Is Joe Biden just feels very self-assured to say civilians are in charge. The State Department is number one. Lloyd Austin is my defense secretary. He's over there. Everybody goes through him to get to me. Thank you very much. And if I need you guys, I'll call you. But once we agree on decisions, I expect zero histrionics associated with it. And so when it came out, you know, how passionately Milley had argued and then speaking out against the decision, effectively saying that, well, you know, I mean, I think this is going to be problematic, which I think landed roughly when Petraeus, I think it was a France 24 interview who had said sort of the same thing. I don't expect things to go well in Afghanistan, that really rankled the White House. I mean, are we in a very different place in terms of senior civil military relations than we were several years ago, although I'm not entirely sure it was all that different under Trump, right? Trump liked the trappings of military people, but he wasn't particularly interested in listening to them either. So maybe it goes back to Obama, right?
But, well, and Obama turned on the chiefs too. It's very clear in his memoirs and conversations and public remarks, and Gates is, I mean, right. So no, yes and no, right? I guess. You know, Congress is increasingly worried about the outsized role of the Joint Staff, of course, which is the chairman's primarily. And we're seeing this reflected in, you know, this global operations tempo, this inability to wrap around, you know, to reduce the demand signal for a department that doesn't have 250,000 forces employed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And yet, you know, the Army's some specialties are at 1-to-1 deployment ratio, you know, dwell to deploy. And that's shocking and totally unsustainable when they're not, most of the force is not in harm's way. So, you know, there is just a general concern that there's too much decision-making in and power resting with the Joint Staff represented by the chairman. Broadly speaking, it manifests in ways that you've outlined. And I think Congress is more likely to do something about it, not in the near term, but in this administration. I think after there's a commission that reviews the Biden defense strategy, they're going to weigh in pretty heavily on this and maybe give Congress a framework for what to do next.
Great. Guys, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you both have a terrific weekend and a terrific week, and look forward to having it back on again next week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And joining us now is Dr. Dov Zakheim, former Pentagon comptroller, who among his many hats is a senior advisor with CSIS. Dov, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's always an honor and a pleasure. We're doing a slightly different format in two pieces, with the domestic side and you talking about the international policy and international affairs side, because we had a very, very busy week. I want to talk first, though, and let you a bite at the apple that both Michael and Mackenzie discussed at the top of the program, which is Liz Cheney. You've written a very thoughtful piece, as usual, in The Hill, that Liz Cheney is a profile in Courage. Summarize your case for the audience.
Well, I mean, she represents Republicanism as we've known it until Mr. Trump showed up on the scene. She's been called a rhino, a Republican in name only, but of course it was Mr. Trump who's a lifetime Democrat. But more importantly is the question that is percolating in a lot of circles, which is whether Liz should leave the party and lead something else. And what I wrote and what I feel strongly about is quite the contrary, that she should stay in the party. She should represent, as she has until now, the longstanding values of the party. You may or may not agree with lower taxes and smaller government and a muscular military that supports diplomacy. But nevertheless, even the President Biden has said you need a Republican Party. And the Republican Party that she represents has been either in government or a loyal opposition for a very long time, whereas the party that Mr. Trump represents is of an entirely different character. She needs to stay in, she needs to lead, and she should only leave when it's impossible, literally impossible for her to stay.
Does the party dove suffer irreparable damage at this point? Because historically, the Republican Party has positioned itself as not the party of passion like Democrats, but the party of empiricism and reason, and that we are fact-driven. And if now we have, as we discussed at the top of the program, the top three Democrats in the House, the top three Republicans in the House all believe in the election lie and refuse to vote to certify a legitimately elected president, does that somehow undermine the ability of the party's credibility more broadly when it comes to things like national security, where there are going to be subjective calls about what is and is not a threat or a program that is or is not important or what have you?
Well, up to now, some of the strongest supporters of defense in the Republican Party have also, unfortunately, been Trump supporters, at least insofar as they didn't vote for his impeachment. So they are able to somehow have split personalities on these issues. I think it's going to take a while for the Republican Party to heal itself. A lot of it, of course, will depend on Mr. Trump and whether he's around and how long he's around and whether he runs again. But I think ultimately, and I guess this is maybe wishful thinking, but I think reason will prevail. The Republican Party has stood for a position that many, many Americans, moderate Americans, have long supported. And it's what this country needs. We need a viable, credible opposition. And obviously, in government, one that is viable and credible. The problem with Mr. Trump was that he was viable for 4 years, but he wasn't credible. And as long as he's on the scene in a major way and is seen to be on the scene, because that's another thing. Let's see what happens in 22 in the elections and how much influence he has. As long as he's seen to be important, it's going to be very difficult for the Republican Party, not just for Liz Cheney, but for the Republican Party.
And I should point out, right, you have always been a longstanding and consistent critic of Donald Trump, even though you are a lifelong conservative Republican in the proudest Ronald Reagan tradition, Dove. Let me take you to the issue of foreign policy, which is what I'd like to get your take on it. Secretary of State Tony Blinken was in Ukraine, gave a tough message, obviously, as the Russians were pulling troops away from the border. But still underscoring that the United States would come to Ukraine's aid. There are some who say, look, that's great, and it's just rhetoric that Russia is there on the border, and if it acted, nobody would oppose them. But if you actually listen to Tony Blinken's language, it suggests otherwise. Was this a smart idea and the right message to be delivered by an American Secretary of State after meeting with the Ukrainian leadership in Kiev?
Well, first of all, by the way, he also told them that we're not very happy with their corruption. So he had a strong message for them as well. Look, the administration has to roll back the impression that the Trump administration gave, that it just didn't give a damn. Yes, it sends defensive weapons to Ukraine, but everybody knew that the whole attitude that the president had toward Ukraine, leaving aside the scandals, was one of basically a studied indifference. We have to demonstrate, not just to Ukraine, I mean, this message is really for NATO Europe and for all our allies, that we are reliable and we will stand with people, just as, for instance, we stood with Kuwait in 1990, and Kuwait certainly wasn't an ally and was next to a very, what we thought was a big and powerful country, namely Iraq. Which had invaded it. There are lots of ways we can support the Ukrainians without putting a single troop on the ground or sending a plane in the air. Everybody knows that. Most important, the Russians know that. And so if I were Mr. Putin, I would simply continue to pull back and not try to push us too hard, because if he does, and he's known this because he's an ex-KGB guy, it could really backfire on his face.
Let me take you to Afghanistan. United States is still pushing ahead with the pullout. There's still a lot of concern. Obviously, David Petraeus and everybody, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, I'm sure irritated the administration last Friday when he made the comment that he was afraid that we might have to go back, or that things might not go well, might be a better way of putting it. Where are we now as this is being, as all this is still moving ahead, United States sending some more aircraft, even as we were trying to wean the Afghans off of our air power and dependency on U.S. troops. What do you see, and what are the most important things that have happened, given your close and deep connections with so many people in Kabul?
Well, I think, first of all, Mr. Ashraf Ghani, who's an old friend, is totally defiant, as he should be, number one. Number two is sending those aircraft is a message, after all. If they come now, they could come again. We wouldn't send troops back, but we could certainly send aircraft back. And we're demonstrating that that is not something that we would be reluctant to do. But more important than the thing to watch is what happens to the spring offensive. The fighting season, as everyone who knows Afghanistan knows, begins when the rivers begin to flood and the trees begin to bloom and the fighters come out of their holes. And so the question becomes, what is the Taliban going to do over the next few months as we're pulling out? Will they be restrained or will they just go ahead and keep fighting as they've been fighting? And we know they've been fighting. And if that's the case, that might give the administration some pause as to whether they should pull out entirely. I have written in The Hill as well that, you know, ultimately, I think if we go this route, I was about to say Saigon, that's a Freudian slip, Kabul will fall, and then we're going to have to figure out what we do. That doesn't have to happen. We have to just see how the spring offensive materializes, and we can always figure out a way to slow the process down. If the Taliban is breaking the rules, as we know they will, that gives us an out.
Let me take you very briefly to the spat between France and Britain over fishing in Jersey. This is more less of a Franco-British, an Anglo-French spat as it is an EU-UK spat, Brexit-driven over fishery access to the waters around Jersey. Jersey, obviously the largest of the Channel Islands and located some 14 miles off the French coast. The concern that I have is just like good neighbors, you go from sharing each other's kitchens invisibly to fighting over trash cans, and the next thing you know, you're building a wall. Are you as concerned about where we're going with this? Because in each of these cases, it appears, or at least some would argue, whether it's the you know, border in the Irish Sea, which is problematic and causing the rise in troubles, to disputes over fisheries. UK fishermen feel like, well, wait a minute, you know, Brexit was supposed to be great for us and it's proving to be not as great. Indeed, it's proving to be not as great across the entire economy. Are you concerned that this is the exact sort of dispute that is being created, that the EU was created to try to avoid, to try to bring longtime adversaries together in a union?
Well, first of all, the Brits and the French have a history of being both adversaries in the Middle Ages, but allies really since World War I. I think one should be careful about blowing this out of proportion. What I do think is of concern, though, is the extent to which they'll cooperate on defense matters. You know, the Brits and the French have been talking about cooperation for at least the past 15 years. And very little has come of it. And it seems to me that if the friction continues, as it may well, it's going to be very, very difficult to get the two most powerful militaries in Western Europe to cooperate. And that is a problem, because as we draw down, and we are drawing down and focusing more on Asia, we need both of them, and we need them both to work together. To me, that's the biggest challenge.
And I should point out, right, I mean, from a British perspective, the Europeans are being unreasonable in wanting to fish in territorial waters that are British. And of course, there have always been debates and anger on the British side that, well, you know, we give up too much of our catch to them and what have you. So I didn't want to make it seem as though it was one sided. Let me take you to a last question, which is Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu, election after election, inability to form government. Where are we now? Where are we going? And what does it mean in the context of where we are with the Iran nuclear discussion, which may change if Benjamin Netanyahu is not sitting in Jerusalem as the prime minister of the state of Israel?
Well, the president of Israel, Ruvi Rivlin, has asked Yair Lapid to, who is the sort of moderate center, if you will, leader, to try to put a government together. It very much depends, though, on whether some of the other parties will go along with him. That is not at all clear. But if he keeps talking about trying to get some national unity in a country that's not in the least bit unified at all, if he can pull it off, then you're going to see a very different attitude toward Israel coming out of the administration. You've already got a challenge in that the rank and file of the Democratic Party is very unsympathetic to Israel, but the administration is walking a fine line. If you have a Bibi Netanyahu back, I could see more friction along the lines of the Obama years. You get a Yair Lapid, that's a very, very different story. He happens to be a charming individual. He's a good listener. He speaks English well and all that. But the most important thing is he's not Bibi Netanyahu. He's not abrasive. He's not going to go to a joint session of Congress and dump on the president of the United States. Frankly, I wish the man well, because, you know, there's a time to hang up your spikes. And you look at Tony Blair, you look at Margaret Thatcher, you look at Charles de Gaulle, you look at Hyman Rickover. They outstay their time. And it really is like a major league ball player who's been a 350 hitter for most of his career and then all of a sudden is batting 220 and will not retire. That's where Bibi Netanyahu is right now. And that's leaving aside all the corruption scandals and the fact that he's trying to wiggle out of them by being prime minister again and getting legislation that would effectively make him totally immune to whatever is done in the justice system.
And very, very briefly, is the administration taking the right tone with the Iranians? Basically, you know, saying, hey, we're happy to talk. And it's great that talks are going on. Proxy talks are going on. We want to see the Iranians move before we do anything. Are they on the right track?
I think they are for two reasons. One, because it reassures not just the Israelis, but the Gulf states that we're not simply caving into the Iranians. And it's important for the Western Europeans in particular, because it shows them that at least we're willing to talk. You know, the tapes of Mr. Zarif, basically the foreign minister of Iran, essentially saying that it's the Revolutionary Guard Corps that runs the country. And they, of course, don't want any kind of deal because they need the great Satan to be the enemy that they fight against, doesn't bode well for any kind of deal. And since that's come out in particular, I think it's very clear to all that talking to Mr. Zarif isn't enough. And so I think the way the administration is handling it, quite frankly, is the right way to do it.
Dov, always a pleasure having you on. Thanks so much for joining us. Hope you have a great weekend, a great week, and hope to have you on again next week. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.